In this episode of 237 of Cider Chat, we're going to be talking to the team at Stormalong Cider. They'll be sharing tips on how they were able to scale up their operations from a setting that was located in a barn to a new production facility. Welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. For all the new listeners out there, welcome aboard to Cider Chat. It's so great to have you along. And for all the regular listeners, well, you know the routine. I'm going to be getting to the featured conversation with Stormalong coming straight away. But first, a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. Well, the big news that would have happened had we not been in a worldwide pandemic is that this week I would have been in the UK on an England cider tour with an amazing group of people. But due to COVID and the necessity to kind of hunker in right now, we had to postpone that cider tour till next year, which means I would not be in Bristol right now as planned, and that's out in West Country. It's a cool city. There's good food there. It's super walkable. There's cider all over the place. And then we'd be like shooting down to Somerset. Oh, then shooting up to Herefordshire. Oh, I'm feeling kind of sad about this. I really am because, one, all right, the cider is just so unique. English cider is so unique. And the variety that they have there, growing both apples and pears, are fantastic. If you haven't been following along on what's going out in that scene, you got to like catch up a bit. I have a bunch of UK cider episodes. And then there's a clutch of people there in all these like little spots, little hamlets. Well, they would call them little shires, I guess. Doing great stuff. And of course, Labor Day weekend was going to be the Ross Cider Fest. And I was so stoked to like see Marco coming in from Italy, and he was going to be sharing some of his quince that he makes. And that was going to be at the Cider Club. Then we're going to be going to the Cider Museum, which, by the way, I heard had some flooding there. So maybe it's, you know, I guess there's a reason for everything and how it happens. Hanging out with Tom Oliver, he was going to welcome us in. Folks at Little Pomona. Go to Weston's. We're going to check that scene out. Look at some big old Perry pears. Hang out with Pilton Cider. It was just such an amazing tour. I mean, sometimes you put something together and you go, oh my God, I cannot believe I'm offering this. This is just like a dream come true. And we know now, I mean, I actually just had this conversation on the phone today with someone saying, we know now that when an opportunity presents itself, do not put it off till tomorrow. That is my theme going forward. And I will be your good pal reminding you of that. And don't put it off because you never know when the world's going to shut down. Anyways, that is a little bit about what's going on for me. And I'm going to take a pause here and I'll be right back.
Walking through the orchards.
This here podcast would not be on the air if not for the benevolence of the good patrons of this here podcast, such as Ambrosia Borowski, Eleanor Leger of Eden Cider. We have a new person who just signed up, and his name is Richard Cockrell. I can't wait to catch up on his story because I think he is based out in Washington State. Don't know yet, but I just saw that email come through, and that was awesome. Just received a bottle from Sean Blaze down in Maryland, a new patron of Cider Chat, letting me check out one of his fine ciders and tell it looks beautiful. We have Barry, who just sent another box of cider in from Germany this weekend, Cider and Perry. I'm going to be doing a recording with him. Then there's some folks on the Cider Going Up campaign, such as Raw Cider and Perry Company, I spoke about earlier, Insider Japan, the only bilingual Japanese and English quarterly magazine, and also an importer of fine cider into that country. Also, Space Time Mead and Cider Works, that's based in Dunmore, Pennsylvania. So those are some commercial cideries, some makers. There's other folks like Original Sin, based in New York. James Creek Cider House is down in North Carolina. Santa Cruz Cider Company has been a great supporter of this podcast for a long time. And if you've been following the news just very recently, there was some horrific fires out there, still some burning in that area, that Santa Cruz County area, which again is a reminder, isn't it? The folks who came on Monterey Cider Tour with me in 2019, you had an opportunity of a lifetime there that, well, actually, I did the tour, a semi-mini tour for CiderCon just this January. There were no fires, and Rider Ranch was looking at maybe evacuating, but I guess they survived. So that's how quick life can go by in a blink of an eye. And again, another good reminder to seize the moment when you have an opportunity to get out into the world, do it. But there's all these other great folks, too, who are just fans of Cider Chat. You just warm my heart. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I tip my glass your way.
Dancing in the streets.
This weekend coming up, the 5th through the 7th, you could get some Cider Chat swag at TeePublic, and it is on sale 35% off, which I'm sure is music to your ears. So that means you could get a really, you know, I think a cool t-shirt like, you know, keep calm, drink cider, or I hear talking palms, accept your species. We really need to do that. All at the TeePublic store front for Cider Chat. I'll put a link in the show notes, or you could just Google it, Cider Chat, TeePublic, and it'll get you there.
Smelling all the blossoms.
It's time now for part two of this ongoing series surrounding cider making in general. Last week's episode was how to make cider at home, starting with a 1 gallon jug of cider. I highly recommend that for anyone who's just even thinking about making cider. Before you go full steam ahead and start getting all the equipment, start with that little step first. So that episode, I just thought, really hit it on the nose, if I do say so myself. This episode this week and following, we're going to be talking with the Stormalong team, and it is about cleaning the equipment. And this was really inspired by a patron of Cider Chat by the name of Max Marshall, who's based up in Canada. And he had asked me, had I ever done anything on this topic? And I realized, no, I hadn't. And it's interesting for me to go there because I'd like to know where everything is sourced from, anything that I kind of consume in that way. I'd like to have an idea of the full spectrum, especially when I'm very passionate about it and it has to do with farming. So when you are thinking about from the perspective of that, it might make the geekiness not be so geeky. And even if you are super geeky, boy, this is so for you. These guys did a fantastic job explaining it to a layperson like myself who isn't super technical. They really hit it on the nose. So I'm going to allow them to introduce themselves first, and then we're going to go into the sanitation piece. And I really want to refer you to the show notes for this here episode 237, because Ben, who spearheaded this for me at Stormalong, gave me great notes that I then formatted into show notes for you. So you'll be able to use that as a reference. So get your cider ready. Should be in a clean glass or from the bottle. Oh, crack this bottle here next to me open. And let's join this chat.
Hi, how's it going? This is Ben Robertson, and I'm the head cider maker at Stormalong Cider, here to talk about cleaning.
Hey, I'm Bright McConnell, and I'm the operations manager.
I'm Shannon Edgar, and I just push the brooms around here.
What he really means to say is that he is the extremely hardworking owner of this fine establishment.
We're here at the Sturmalong Cidery in Leominster. This is not the original site. Originally started in Sherborne, Massachusetts. Had a conversation with both Shannon and Ben way back, probably in season one of Cider Chat, about 5 years ago, right before you guys set out to move this whole operation here to Leominster. And it's a much larger scale of operation. You're on the industrial road, yet as soon as you pull in, it has that cidery feel. So this particular chat is about how you scale up and informing people a little bit about the process of Sturmalong and how anyone thinking about coming into this as an operation, some of those considerations. I want to first like touch base just with Shannon on that move.
You know, we didn't have like a big long-term plan when we first started this into this business. And I think originally we had been thinking we were going to stay small and do single serve like bottles and kind of grow a lot of our own food as much as we could, etc. So our original facility was sort of set up for that, and it was in a barn, and you know we had a certain ceiling. And then I think as the market and the cans quicker than we had anticipated, or if we ever were going to go into them, and that sort of opened up the floodgates of what we needed for infrastructure. And we had an opportunity to lease some space in the same building that we were pressing juice, pressing apples. And that kind of started in a smaller scale here, that like in Leominster. And, you know, we just said, but, you know, we're going to need to scale up here. There's no way, we don't have the infrastructure that we need in Sherburn. And to put that infrastructure in a place that didn't have sewer and different utilities that you would need, it just didn't make any sense to make the kind of investment. So this was a good opportunity for us in Leominster, and we you know, we started this process in like mid 2016, and sort of grew into it slowly, and we were operational here by like the beginning of 2017, I think.
It was a no-brainer to do that. Of course you had to scale up, no
yeah.
doubt. But in that process, you're going from, when I was in the barn, it was a barn.
Right.
There were barrels around. It was a kind of a more, you know, cozy space in a way. And now you're here at this, like, grand scale. You got a lot more people on board, meeting Bright for the first time. How much study did you have to do to kind of, like, register up and say, okay, now we're switching from carboys, small barrels, to, like, large stainless system?
A lot of that's on Ben, which he can talk about on the technical side of like trying to figure out, you know, how to make this up at the scale that we are at now. But I think a lot of it was sort of grow as you go, because, you know, we weren't sure what the future was going to be as far as sales go and what the demand was going to be like. So kind of swung for the fences on our first foray into buying bigger tanks and stuff. And I think when we talked about it and discussed options, we decided, you know, we don't want to go from point A to point B to point C, because that middle ground of not buying big enough when you're investing into stainless and stuff is not a good idea. But Ben can talk about the size of the tanks and some of the things.
So, I mean, a lot of things changed from there to here. I kind of started out at a more commercial scale in my first year of cider making. So a big thing for me coming to Sturmalong was learning more traditional methods, longer aging time, multiple rackings, potentially allowing for co-fermentation and using barrel aging is a major part of things. And so learning about this sort of other type of cider making, non-commercial cider making, was a huge eye-opening for me. You know, first when I went for the job interview with Shannon, he drove me around the orchard where he was growing heirloom fruit, and I had never seen heirloom fruit trees before so far in my career. So it was a major difference for me. And so I sort of unlearned a lot of what I had learned in my first job, and then found a way to apply some of that knowledge about fine cider making and more farm-style cider making to scaling up. And so I went from, particularly if we want to talk about Legendary Dry, you know, we started going from, you know, co-fermenting and doing some barrel aging to, you know, scaling up that barrel aging project scaling up and doing some actual lacto-fermented pitches and really nailing down exactly what the product parameters we were looking for in something that's supposed to have the feel of a long-aging fine cider, but that we make 3,000 gallons of every month now. So also going from that sort of smaller bottle perspective, when you have a really long time to let yeast drop out, to let things come to fruition, and to make it easier to sort of stabilize, particularly when using a dry product. As we moved into cans, we made that move partially because we weren't in a place to start a tap room. And when you are really only selling, directly to consumers, not directly to consumers, but selling to stores through a distributor, you need to have more options. And for a lot of people, that means a sweeter cider. But we wanted to also keep, we didn't want to compromise on the quality. So we came out with mass appeal, and we found a way to stabilize that product without the modern technology that we have now. So we've slowly taken our steps, learning more about filtration, pasteurization, use of sulfites, and then eventually being able to move away from those in order to, start with good fruit. Process it in a consistent way, but also to make sure that once I put it in a can, it's going to be the same thing when I drink it a few days later, a few months later, and at the end of its shelf life.
That's what's really something to kind of note here about your operation versus like an orchard-based operation where they're going to be kind of doing like vintages over, each year. And Sturmalong is like a modern cidery in that aspect, where it's not necessarily, every year is going to have different fruit, but you're trying to look for consistency of your
I think we have a viewpoint where we take the same methodology that an orchard-based cidery, I think we would consider ourselves in some ways an orchard-based cidery, if I could quote some of the things that one of our colleague Steve Wood has talked about. I mean, so we buy fruit that's, we're intentionally buying to use in cider that's been, bought directly from an orchard. We're not buying just random stuff out there. And I think what we've done is we've taken the scale and the technology of a bigger operation like we are now, and we've applied the same kind of lessons and results that we've learned in the traditional sense. So it's kind of like a merging of the two worlds. I think the only major difference between what we do now is we have a limited amount of products that we have longer fermenting and aging times than maybe some of our other products, where we are using barrels and we are using a variety of other techniques. But that kind of goes along with our core products that we're making a little bit quicker. And using maybe some more filtration techniques and things like that to stabilize. So we still do that orchard, smaller, longer aging products, but the reality is, our bigger volume is in the stuff that we're turning a little bit quicker with the use of some of the technology that we have now.
Right. So are you pulling fruit from Farnham Hill? You mentioned Steve Wood.
We do pull some fruit from
Farnham, and so is New Hampshire, Massachusetts fruit.
It's all New England. We do pull some from New York. Uh-huh. There's just so many apples in New York. It's hard not to buy
it's
apples from New York.
It's great that you're using all these resources. I'm all for it. I think when I say orchard based, I mean more like the cider's right next to the orchard and the
sure,
kind of
sure.
It's more maybe we should call it like boutique orchard.
Right. Well. Yeah, I think there's a lot of nomenclature out there that people get hung up on and try to market, especially some of the really big brands. They throw the word heirloom and other things around, and it's hard to really distinguish what that actually means, in the big picture right now. But when we say heirloom, it's an heirloom variety of fruit.
Good enough.
One thing that I've definitely seen that sets Shannon apart a little bit from, past experience is that he really does put an emphasis on the fruit and thinking ahead and paying attention to what fruit we'll be getting, even at this really large scale. And as we've been scaling up, making sure that we have access to quality fruit and that it's timed throughout the season, you know, as you go from cold storage fruit to CA fruit to the sort of end of CA fruit, maybe there's some imported fruit. And then, you know, really trying to work with growers that we know in the region to get, you know, the stuff that's going to be very best in the early season, mid season, and into the winter. And without, you know, the huge amount of effort that he puts into that, our cider wouldn't be as good, because I don't think I could, you know, possibly keep together all those relationships. You know, having the material to work with is everything, because if you don't start with good juice, you're not going to make good cider.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah.
And just to kind of reach back around to like the consistency thing, one of the things that I really like about Stormalong is that we shoot for consistency insofar as we can do within the natural range of what the apple is presenting us. You know, Legendary Dry is one of those things that you open up a can, it's not always going to taste exactly the same. Sometimes, you know, we get fruit from seed that's like heavy on the Dabinets, and like it will come out a little bit different, and then the next can, the next batch will be different. But what I appreciate that is that we almost appreciate and acknowledge those differences, but that's just kind of what Legendary Dry is. It's a presentation of like the fruit itself, and yeah. Not trying to bend it too much to
our we're not adding like acids, and we're not adding any kind of our like additional adjuncts to get it to a certain level. It's like we can pick the fruit, we can look at sugar levels and acid levels that the apples are naturally giving us, and we can blend. We do keep a lot of different, you know, things like some barrel stock around and different things that we can use to get the flavor, but we're blending it the way a winery would blend a wine. You know, we're pulling from some different, you know, we have a big batch, and now we're kind of blending that with other smaller batches to make it to where we want it to keep as consistent as our taste buds are telling us that we want it to be. You know?
And I think it's okay to expect that a cider is going to change from year to year, because that's the beauty of like pulling fruit from different years.
Fruit
so
season,
cider
yeah.
drinkers should
yeah.
know that. I mean, that, you know, that expectation is just kind
it's
of
It's a
ridiculous.
Little rough, because the expectation in the world of beer is complete consistency all the time. And Bright and Shannon and I had to kind of, you know, go back to the drawing board and make a decision about this, you know, recently as we're getting bigger about, you know, just in order to have all the numbers line up and to be exactly the same on every batch, we were going to have to lose some of the magic of just letting the apples do their own thing. You know, we considered, like, what if we started adding acid or adjusting for sugar? And I think we all came to a place where we kind of decided that the variance batch to batch was acceptable and more important to let the apple shine through and keep its magic than to be exactly the same every time.
Yeah, I love that. Let the apple shine through. I mean, that's why you're doing it, right?
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. What was that process of that next step from the beautiful, quintessential New England barn setup, but doesn't necessarily work for the scale that you're working at? So how did you go about that?
I mean, I think we just, it was sort of a step by, like, a, you know, growing by year. Like, you know, we knew we were putting feet down here in our location in Lemonster. But even this building, I mean, you know, our landlord and the owner of the building, you know, they recently added 20,000 square feet onto the building from the time we originally took the space. So, you know, it's been a growth just by the nature of the need to grow. And, you know, we had an opportunity to do that in this location. And I think a lot of it was, you know, done in stages because that's just the way it happened, you know, organically. I mean, Ben, you know, we worked on the design with Ben and of the original set of tanks. We scaled up last year with bigger tanks and more footprints and, you know, so it's just, it's a continual evolution. And, you know, right now we're actually, you know, trying to do a deeper dive into like, what does this look like 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road? Because I think we have just sort of been going with the flow a little bit. And now we're kind of at that point where we're like, wait, now we have a little bit more history so we can actually do some projections and stuff. But like, when you're at a scale where you're just kind of getting going, and even if we want, you know, like when you move it into cans and then bigger volumes, it's all an evolution. And without data, like real data, you know, you can guess all you want to, and you can have all these wonderful plans, but you know, until you actually know what's happening, it's very difficult to project.
Well, I think that's where a lot of cider makers are, and that's why we wanted to have this conversation, because I've been getting these emails from folks saying, you know, what do I need to think about, and what is the actual technical piece of cleaning that I need to think about too? And Ben, you set up this really nice like little overview here. I thought it'd be great to go over that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what are sort of the basics of cleaning? So I'm going to start with some theory, and then we're going to work into chemicals that we generally use. And then finally, some different things about cleaning at different scales and the hangups that you can have at each scale.
Perfect.
So first question is, like, you know, you hear sanitary being thrown a lot in the world of cleaning. And sanitary parts are what's most often used to convey cider or juice from one place to another. So materials that touch cider should be made of a material that is non-porous and resistant to scratching or chemical degradation. So that'd be stainless steel, glass, HDPE, polypropylene, silicone or other food-grade rubbers, Teflon, or specially prepared concrete or an enamel-coated vessel. The purpose of that is that you need to provide, you cannot provide a surface for bacteria or soils to build up on and become hardened, because you'll have a lot of issues with cleaning. Very often when people are starting out, they'll sort of work with whatever pipe parts or other parts that they have. It's really important that you avoid metals like aluminum, brass, mild steel, copper, or bronze, or even chrome-plated parts, because they're not rated for food contact, and they should not be used on any part of your system that touches product or CO2. That also goes for non-food-grade rubbers. If you're wondering if a rubber is food-grade, give it a smell. If it has a significant smell, it is not a food-grade rubber. Just put that out there. Copper, which a lot of people think of as being really good because people think it purifies spirit. I'm not a distiller, but copper is toxic, and it can easily absorb into a cider because it dissolves in acids. So there should be no direct contact between any copper parts in your cider.
Unless you want to pour the cider over the copper to, like, remove...
You're actually not supposed to do that. Soham, I had talked
From
about
Artifact.
This with him, and he brought my attention to the fact that the allowable level of copper is in the parts per billion. And when you look at the weight of copper, you can actually weigh a piece of copper that you flow cider past, and it will weigh less when you are done flowing cider over it. So really the only safe way to add copper is through copper sulfate. And that has its own problems. But I would definitely recommend against letting any copper touch your cider, even if it's sulfate. There are other options that wouldn't run the risk of contamination.
Good to know.
Also, that goes for brass, because brass contains copper and it will leach out. Aluminum will corrode in either contact with cider or cleaning chemicals. And in cleaning chemicals, it will actually plate onto the stainless. So if you have an aluminum part in a bucket of stainless parts, it can actually ruin those parts.
You got to be careful, because a lot of these parts companies will have mixed stainless and aluminum parts on the same thing. So you'll think it'll be a sanitary part all the way and try cleaning through it and end up, you know, screwing the pooch.
Is that because you're using equipment from different sources, like, you know, like a brewer from a brewery would go to a certain, like, brew supply store? So as a cider maker, you're probably coming through a winemaker supply house.
We have a number of different suppliers. And it also just has to do with, you know, with cost, and not every supplier has everything that we're looking for.
Right.
So there's that as well. It's also important to note that steel parts, ungalvanized steel parts, while they're not necessarily toxic, if you allow any rust to come in contact with your stainless steel equipment, like even just a rusty part, millions and millions of little rust seeds can break off and attach to the stainless and create a surface for rust to start. And once you start getting pitting or any sort of roughness on your stainless tanks or pipes, those create surfaces for stuff to attach to. When you get a biofilm, you're not going to be able to clean that in a normal way. It's also important to note that brass, if it's not lead-free, could leach lead. So avoid putting in any of that stuff in with your cleaning buckets or in contact with cider. Next question here is, like, what makes a part sanitary? It must have a smooth geometry, no hidden or dead spots. It must be easily disassembled for cleaning. For example, like a ball valve isn't really sanitary unless you were to completely take it apart every time you use it, because the surfaces of the ball, or at least some of them, are always hidden from the chemical action. So,
Ben, one thing I wanted to mention on the brass and chrome and all that, those tips, that most of the time you're going to encounter that type of stuff has to do with kegs and tapping systems and smaller scale homebrews type of stuff. In that world, you know, different, you know, Sankey connectors and homebrew connectors, like, that's where you can find the stuff a lot. So just be careful when you're doing the small batch stuff, because usually at the bigger scale, it's, you know, you're getting more in the stainless 100%, whatever. It's a little bit less, but I find, like, kegging stuff, anything to do with kegs, you get a lot of tap systems, all that stuff. There's varying degrees of what is allowed in the world.
Recipes here and there. Yeah. Like, even some of them will say that they're stainless, but when you start to get a sharp eye for what plated brass looks like, or mild steel, you very quickly realize that the all stainless cup holder you just bought is a mixture of steel, brass, plated brass, and actual stainless.
Yeah. So when you're making your transfers with your homebrew ciders and stuff, just be cognizant of it, you know.
Good point, Shannon. Yeah.
So in with saying that, like, things like ball valves can't really be sanitary, a really big one that gets smaller cideries and breweries is that you really shouldn't have any threaded parts that directly contact liquid. And if you do, you should boil them at least periodically. Threaded parts cannot be considered stainless. Cannot be considered sanitary because of the fact that that deep V groove on, you know, in the root of the thread, it just does not get enough mechanical action or chemical action from the cleaning chemicals moving past it to dislodge stuff that can get in there. And that goes for any kind of deep scratches or any other really porous or high surface area surface. You're going to get buildup, and you're not generally, you know, if it's a really rough surface, you're not going to be able to get that buildup off with normal CIP methods. I don't know if, Bright, do you want to talk a little bit about barrels or other things that are allowed to be, it's a gray area where
right.
It can be a good, they can be a good vessel, but they're really not considered, like, sanitary.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, barrels are kind of like a perfect example of where they're never going to be truly sanitary, but that's kind of by design. You know, once you use a barrel, like, a few times, like, you get, like, a nice neutral barrel, you can kind of build up, like, a really healthy biome in there of helpful bacteria that will kind of, like, relatively reproducibly mature and act on the cider in a way that you can expect and enjoy. Sometimes they go south, and, you know, you have a barrel that you have to dump out on the floor, which is unfortunate, but, you know, it happens. But there are, like, some basic ways that you can kind of, like, help clean barrels. So you don't ever want to use, like, any kind of, like, super harsh food safe chemicals to clean those things. So typically when it comes to cleaning barrels, use a citric acid solution or sulfites to actually wash and spray out the inside of the barrels, or just really hot water.
Do you have a steam cleaner here for your barrels? Do you use that?
No. So we typically do, like, a sulfite or a citric acid wash on it. Yeah.
We have really hot water too.
And really hot water. Yeah.
And when you're doing the citric acid solution for that, are you doing that? You're doing a whole bunch of barrels at the same time.
Yeah. So
I was kind of wondering, like, you know, what's a measurement for citric acid? Because I have this, you know, smaller barrel that I have, and so if I'm moving from, like, the small hobbyist side going and scaling up, how much citric acid are, you know, how many barrels are you cleaning at the same time?
Oh, I mean, we're usually doing, like, 20 or 30 at a time. We have a spray ball that fits up inside the barrel, and we usually do a rinse rather than filling them, just because it would be a massive amount of liquid to fill them all, or you would have to transfer from one to another. I'm usually looking at like a 2-3% solution. Sometimes I just eyeball it, because citric acid, unlike other things, it could have a flavor effect in the barrel.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt anyone.
It's kind of pH dependent too. You're trying to get to a low pH, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing to watch out for, Bright thankfully hasn't had this issue yet in his career, but I, early in my career, was exposed to way too many sulfites because I was not careful enough. Sulfites are extremely dangerous. They're one of the most dangerous chemicals you'll contact in a cidery, and they're a sensitizer, so the more times that you breathe in sulfite gas, the more likely you will be to have an allergic reaction. And any time that sulfites contact an acidic solution, they will outgas. So if you are mixing a sulfite hot water solution or sulfite citric solution, which I don't necessarily recommend, you really, anytime you're working with sulfites, you should have a full face gas mask on. You know, some people are like, I'm fine. Well, you'll be fine until you have an asthma attack, which happened to me my first year working at Stormalong, because I had, up until then, hadn't become sensitive. So I did what I usually do. And then all of a sudden I found myself extremely short of breath, and had to go outside and catch my breath. And I had no idea what was going on until the next time I handled sulfites and had the same reaction. So it's really important to head that off and be safe from the time you start using them.
Fantastic. Thank you for the sharing of that.
The other thing, tip on barrels that I think we try to follow, which is a pretty simple tip, an easy tip, is to keep them full with cider at all times. So, it's something that you think is easy, but when you're moving things around and racking and doing stuff, you know, you're like, oh, I'll get to it. I'll put some more cider back in those things. And then they sit around for 2 weeks and it's toast, you know, because so you have to be really regimented about keeping liquid in them at all times, because they'll get leaky, they'll have bad stuff grow in them, and et cetera.
That is so true. True with carboys, though, too.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get into some cleaning theory.
When you're cleaning any kind of dirty vessel, they're the four big factors that you really need to keep an eye on while you're processing that cleaning thing. That's going to be temperature of like the liquid that you're cleaning it with, the mechanical action, how effective, like, and how hard or strong and thorough of a spray that you're actually getting. That's going to help break off those bits off of the side of the tank or barrel or what have you. The concentration of the cleaning chemical that you're using and the duration of the actual clean itself. Those are four things that you always need to keep an eye on with whatever you're cleaning. Make sure you're keeping an eye on, you know, also visual inspection at the end of it all is like certainly something that's paramount. You know, if it doesn't look clean, it probably isn't. It also kind of depends on what you're going to be cleaning at that point in time. Totes, for anybody that's scaling up from carboys, is will probably almost invariably at some point in time use IBC totes. They're absolutely wonderful for cider making, especially on a much smaller scale. Notoriously a pain in the ass to clean. So with things of that nature, definitely mechanical actions, one of like the biggest things, and chemical concentration. So they're harder to clean, so usually when I'm cleaning totes, I like to up the concentration a little bit. I usually just call it like a double strength clean. So if typically using 1.5 ounces of sodium hydroxide solution per gallon, I'll use maybe 3 ounces of sodium hydroxide solution.
And you'll notice that Bright didn't mention temperature, and part of that is because totes really aren't supposed to be cleaned above 120-130 degrees, and so tote cleaning and what he described is a perfect example of using those four major factors and varying them. So if you don't have a lot of time, well, you're going to need more temperature, more mechanical action, and more chemicals. If you can't have high temperature, then you're going to need more chemicals, a harder spray, and you're going to need to run the cycle for longer. So varying those depending on what you have. Maybe you don't have a good hot water supply. Maybe you can't use strong chemicals because you're on a septic system. You know, those are all things that you're if you know you're going to be deficient in one of these four categories, you can amp up the other categories to get where you need. Both me and Bright have, you know, with totes that are causing a lot of issues, sometimes we even have to up the mechanical action even further and use a pressure washer to get off the worst soils before we even start with our chemical.
And sometimes we just have to get rid of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yes. Or, you know, reach in and get a scrubby brush in there. And
yeah.
Elbow deep.
So, you know, you would think that you could always just, like, run a clean for longer if you have this option, but it is important to remember, or just go crazy high on chemicals and not waste any of your time. It's important to remember that, you know, particularly rubber parts, but even stainless steel can be chrome oxide layer on the outside can be worn down by heavy cleaning over time. So none of your parts are totally invincible. You're going to want to clean thoroughly enough, but there is such a thing as too much of a good thing.
I think the biggest obvious tip that I could give people on totes, having cleaned a fair amount of them myself back in the day, you know, pressure washer obviously should be a tool in your repertoire, and it's obvious, but when you get done with them, clean them out, rinse them out with the pressure washer so there's no, like, residual cider at the bottom of it, because it's hard to get it all out of there. And if you get it out, then, you know, you're in a much better position for to actually get the thing clean.
Yeah, but once a biofilm dries on, like, a surface, it's next to impossible to get off the thing. So I know it's really hard after a long day of, like, production to be like, all right, now let me clean this thing. But a lot of times, like, you really just kind of got to bite the bullet and, you know, make sure you clean those items before they get fully dry. Because it's once that dries out that it really adheres itself to the surface.
Mm-hmm. So just to, like, get back to what Bright said earlier, and this is sort of like the golden rule other than the four parameters, is if something doesn't look clean, it's not. And if it is not clean, it cannot be sanitized to be ready for accepting cider. And if any of your parts touches a visibly unclean surface, do not pass go. Go directly back to the cleaning bucket and fully reclean it again. Because that's exactly how the worst, you know, somebody's got a gasket and they're trying to hook something up. They got a heavy hose in one hand, gasket drops in the, you know, next to the drain. And they rinse it off and put it back in, and all of a sudden you've contaminated, you know, hundreds or thousands of gallons of cider.
Not a mistake you could do in a commercial operation at the scale that you're at.
No,
it would be a bad mistake.
It's sad when I lose 5 gallons of cider.
Yeah. It's, also not as if, it's also not as if small cideries can really afford to lose any cider either, you know?
Right.
So true.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, and I think the other thing to think to be okay is, like, you're going to make mistakes. Like, there's going to be a learning curve to all this stuff. But the more things that you can do ahead of it, I think the information is getting better. And obviously, you know, things like Cider Chat is helping that along. But when we first started, you know, cider was, you know, it's been around, but it's fairly new. And I think we were learning as we go to some degree. You guys were back in the day. And, you know, it's helpful to have these resources. And I would also say, and these guys might have this in the notes too, but your suppliers, your chemical companies, your you know, those type of places can be extremely helpful in this department, and make friends with them out of the gate. We Scott Labs has been great for us.
Shout out to Alpha Chemical.
Yeah, Alpha Chemical. Yeah. You know, a lot of those folks have been really helpful and will help smaller places getting going. I highly recommend you making friends with them and buying.
It's all about relationships and business, isn't it? And you can't undermine yourself.
Not sure.
Not, you know, to be kind to people, it goes a long way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, don't be afraid to listen. You're going to hear some stuff you don't want to, because they're going to tell you that you have to do more or spend more money or more work. But, you know, you'll either learn when they tell you or learn when you make a mistake.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well said.
Thank you so much, Ben, Bright, and Shannon. You guys knocked it out of the park. If you'd like to hear the first episode recorded with Storm Long, you want to go back to episode number 36. That was in season one of Cider Chat, and that was recorded in the barn before they moved to their current site in Lemonster, a world apart away. But you could also see at that time the technical aspect of cider making that they were diving into. That Ben, he just blows me out of the water, and he's so well spoken too. So a real treasure for all of us to have this. And again, there's more to be found from this conversation in the show notes if it felt like kind of overwhelming. Next week, we're going to be continuing along with our conversation and talking about chemicals used for cider making, both for the hobbyists and the commercial cidery. And I think you'll find it pretty darn informative. So stay tuned for that. If you haven't subscribed to Cider Chat yet, please do. And with that, I leave you here. This is Real Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider, we like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!